If you're new here, my name is Joel. We're doing a series of messages through this autumn term called Stereo Heart, during which we've looked at the subject of confidence in God and the kind of things that can upset our confidence. Today I want to look really at one story from the Gospel of Matthew. It's the first book in the New Testament, so if you've got your Bible with you or on your phone or something, turn to Matthew 14 and we'll read from verse 22 to verse 33. This is a story about Jesus and his 12 disciples, the closest 12 to him. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." He said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." In the days of the U.S. Civil War, Abraham Lincoln, who was the president of America, sacked his chief commanding officer. The reason he did it was not because he had poor credentials. He had the best credentials. This is General George McClellan. He was a well-known and respected figure amongst the military community. And it seemed as though from his CV that this guy was going to set the world on fire. It turns out that's exactly what he didn't do. He really didn't do anything. This general, who seemed to be so impressive on paper, was utterly incapable of engaging the enemy. And there was always a reason for it. He always was able to say, you know, "Well, we haven't got enough troops. We need more reinforcements. We haven't got enough ammunition. We haven't got enough supplies. And the lines aren't measured correctly. And we're not able to engage them because there's too many of them. We can't see them. There's too few of them." There was some kind of reason, you know, there's something good on telly. There was something that prevented him from engaging them each time. And it seemed as though he was waiting for the absolutely perfect conditions before he would even dream of taking a step. But that's probably an example of how many of us go through life in general on our individual journey. I don't know what you're like. If you're the kind of person that finds it easy to make big, brave decisions, or if you're more like McClelland in that you tend to find yourself waiting for the perfect circumstances in every situation. I need to be 100% certain that everything will go according to how I want them to. All the predictions that I can make are you know, sort of perfectly guaranteed, and I'm just absolutely comfortable that everything's slotted into place before I make a decision each time. But sometimes we might do that in our relationships with people. We might do that in our relationships with God. We might do that in our life of trying to follow Jesus. We know that we are interested in following him. Perhaps we're even interested in becoming Christians, but we're held back by what seems on our account to be a lack of the perfect circumstances. If only this would happen, then I would trust God. If only this would come clear, then I would trust God. If only I would get this sorted out, then I would follow God. The truth is, you may actually be waiting indefinitely, and that's not the only problem. There's actually a huge lesson to learn from this story here that you need to bear in mind as well, and that is that you might have all of the things you're asking for and still struggle to trust him. That's really one of the major things to learn here. This is Simon Peter. He's been following Jesus now for a couple of years, I guess. He's a seasoned veteran disciple. He's experienced around Jesus. He's seen Jesus do miracles, miracle after miracle. And on this occasion, after having spent quite a long part of the night on the open sea in the storm, he sees Jesus approaching him on the water, walking on the sea. That in itself ought to be quite a persuasive clincher. If ever a person was able to say, okay, I've seen enough. I trust him now. I've seen enough. I'm persuaded. I got my clincher. You know, I wonder what your clincher would be. Perhaps you'd like Jesus to turn up in your bedroom tonight and sit on the end of your bed and read you a story or something. You'd like some kind of specific thing that if only he did this. And Peter's surely got the one and only thing by now. And just to cap it all, just to sort of take it to the next level, he himself gets to walk on the water. He steps out of the boat at Jesus' instruction and walks towards him. You'd think that the guy would never, ever struggle in his faith again. There'll never be an issue of confidence in Peter's heart because he's seen enough now. And yet what we find is what we see in verse 30. He says, when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me!" And this, by the way, is one of the kind of signs of the Bible's authenticity. Who would make this story up? That part of it, especially. Who would make? Surely, if it was like made up by someone who wanted to just impress us, especially if it was a friend of Peter's who wanted to keep Peter's reputation good. We wouldn't get that part. We'd just get, you know, Peter went out in the storm and him and Jesus tap danced back to the shore to the tune of I'm Singing in the Rain. You know, just this perfect, natural, happy ending to the story. But no, we see this embarrassing, humiliating. It's kind of tough for Peter, shameful almost for Peter. He's got a big lesson he's had to learn. This has been a difficult moment in his story, and it's right here, kept for us as we read the Bible 20 centuries later, so that we can see for ourselves that the clincher for which we might be waiting before we take a step of trust towards God, it might in itself not be the thing we really need. The problem might not be out there. The problem might still be in here. The problem might still be within. That's definitely Peter's experience. And I want to just spend some time today trying to unpack what we can learn from Peter and hopefully learn about ourselves. And I'm going to break it down into three parts. The first part is just temperament, the role that temperament plays in our relationship with God and our ability to trust God and make decisions. Secondly, emotions, just how emotions play such a huge part. That's not a new subject in this series. It's come up quite a lot, but it needs to be given its due place. And then finally, indecision, indecisiveness. So we'll start with a place of temperament before we move on. And that's a big deal with Peter. Peter's a temperamental fellow. If you've read any parts of the New Testament before, if you get to know the stories about Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the biographers of Jesus that are preserved for us in the New Testament, Peter's probably the main figure in the story except for Jesus. He's kind of the most vocal disciple. And he is the one who is most impulsive, most impetuous, most likely to take out his sword and slice off someone's ear for no reason, most likely to sort of make a big, brave decision and then step back from it later on when it starts to get a bit difficult. He's an impulsive guy. He thinks with his heart. He's an emotionally driven guy. He's passionate. He's actually someone that you can't help liking. And people like me are very glad that he's in the Bible because he reminds me of me sometimes. I'm sure for some of you it's the same. He's an impulsive kind of person. And there's lots to be encouraged by, but there's some things to be warned by as well. His temperament is quite particular. I guess it's worth just pointing out the differences between people and how those differences can bring about in your individual life certain kinds of difficulties, trials, temptations that are unique to you in your life and in your relationship with God. Not everybody's the same. Not everybody is tempted by the same things. Not everybody is tried and tested by the same circumstances and inward dispositions. We're not the same. I have five children, last count, and one of them is not the same as the others. They're all different. All five of them, they got their own personality. And as they grow up, it gets more and more divergent and fascinating. And you kind of expect when you first start having children, it's going to be like pumping out an assembly line. You know, we're going to be pretty much the same. But no way. I mean, just fascinating things that you see, you know, taking them to help them to start riding a bike and the different ways that they respond in that situation. I remember, you know, in some the case of some I don't even remember teaching one of them. Neither does my wife. She just got on and rode. Just got on. I mean, just we can't even remember. And then others, it's like they're more careful and cautious and asking questions and taking some time. And you put in the hours with them to help them make sure that they can do it. And it's just fascinating. I mean, it's like that with just one family, let alone the whole church, the whole range of people who are trying to follow Jesus. Your particular difficulties and weaknesses are different than mine, and mine are different than yours. And we mustn't overly kind of squash ourselves into some binary kind of industrial scale utilitarian Christianity where we all have the same exact problems and the same exact difficulties. And that's not helpful. We need to be more real. And also remember that God knows you for who you are, knows the weaknesses that you have. And he's fair. He understands you. He knows the weaknesses. It doesn't mean he excuses our wrongdoing and our wrong attitudes, but he knows the particular weaknesses and trials and temptations that you are more accustomed to than other people. Peter has his own. I would say one of the main things to learn from this is you should get to know your own. Get to know. Be sure to know what is an area of spiritual weakness in your life. Where do you struggle where you see other people don't struggle? Don't get jealous. Don't get bitter. Just learn from it. Watch for it. Be careful for it. Other people have to be careful for other things. Some of you, your issue is similar to Peter's. You are terminal second guessers. You guess, you're constantly asking, constantly going back, going back, going back, going back. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure about this. Other people, it's like one of my kids riding a bike. They never even look back. Never even think about it. And for the person that's constantly difficult, making their mind up, not really sure, you need to kind of know that about yourself and be aware of it in the development of your trust and confidence towards God. This is related to the second point, which is just the whole issue of emotions. And emotions play a big part in Peter in this story. So back to verses 24 through to 26, it says this: the boat by this time was a long way from the land. So this is before Jesus has shown up. Beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. Now this is kind of, it's ladling on a few extra factors here, just to remind us of the emotional turmoil that Peter has been through in the build-up of this story. He, in obedience to Jesus, has got in the boat to travel across the lake, and the lake is right out in what feels like open sea, a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, the wind is against them, and it's the fourth watch of the night. So they are basically in what feels like a storm that has gone on for hours, and they are manning this little boat themselves, knowing that people do perish on the Sea of Galilee in storms. So this has been a trying time for them, draining, physically, emotionally. Ever been in a storm? Ever been in a storm all night? Ever been out in the open in a storm? Ever been out in a boat in the storm? Ever been out in a boat on the sea in a storm? Manning the boat, trying to keep it together, not sure when you get to the end of the journey, the wind against you. He must have felt, honestly, just at the end of himself. By the time Jesus shows up, I'm sure there's a level of emotional exhaustion that has kicked in. And we need to be aware of that in this situation. It's not without context. And it's worth just kind of sympathizing with him for that reason, for sure. It's worth sympathizing with anybody who struggles in being able to just be confident in God in a situation, who's been through a lot of difficult emotional turmoil. And frankly, that's pretty much all of us, surely. If you've lived life, you've been through some degree of emotional turmoil. You've been up and you've been down. You've had seasons of joy, seasons of pain. You've struggled. I don't know what with, but you struggled. And God calls you to trust him and follow him. And you can feel, God, yeah, but I'm kind of emotionally a little weary and a little bit wary as well. I'm not sure what to expect. Maybe you're aware of some things in your own past that don't seem to go away consciously. You kind of carry them around. Maybe some fears, maybe some things that have happened to other people who followed God. You think, what if that happened to them and they follow Jesus, then am I safe? And there are kind of constant questions and what ifs that keep creeping up on you at the times when you don't need them to, and they rob you of your rest and your peace, and it feels like waves bashing against the hull, bashing against the boat of your life. The last thing you can really ever imagine doing is walking out on the water. Emotional weariness plays its part, certainly in Peter's life, and surely no less in ours. But having been sympathetic with him and with each other for a moment, let's just ask ourselves an important question here. Before we just show sympathy, let's just be objective. Has Peter received any new information to cause him to lose his confidence in Jesus at this point? This is a key question. It's the key question of the whole message that I'm doing today. Okay, so follow me on this. He has seen his master, his friend, walking on the water. Trust me, that in itself is fairly sensational. And he's a fisherman. He knows the lake. He's been out on it a few times. It's his job. He knows where the shallow bits are. Some people have tried to say, well, possibly Jesus walked on a shallow bit and they all thought he was walking on water. Come on! These guys, they know the lake, and they're not idiots as well. I think the people who interpret the Bible sometimes are, but Peter definitely isn't. He knows that Jesus is walking. This is a full-on miracle. So that in itself is striking information. Then Peter himself walks on the water. There's some information as well. What happens between that and Peter's thinking? New information? Something new? Does he discover something new about Jesus? Does he discover something new about water? No, nothing new. All he does is he goes back in his mind to the past. He knew everything he needed to know. He knew about the waves. He's been out on the storm all night. It's not as if he looked at the waves and thought, it's a storm! Wait a minute, you've been on this is the fourth watch of the night, remember? This nothing new here. What's going on, Peter? I'll tell you what's going on. Peter hasn't made up his mind. He hasn't made up his mind. See, Peter is behaving like many contemporary people, very, very many modern people who trust God in a moment of impulse. They step out. They make a decision to follow Jesus. And there's an excitement about it. There's a passion. There's an emotion about it. They're caught up in something. And it feels so exciting. And they discover that actually it's real. It's real. It's actually real. I trust God. Wow, hey, he's trustworthy. This is amazing. But the thing that has led them this far, it seems, is their own emotional kind of heights. They haven't necessarily thought it through yet. They haven't come to a place of inner persuasion. They haven't actually got to a logical conclusion. They've just been caught up in a moment. Now, it's not wrong to feel emotion. In fact, it's wrong, ultimately wrong, never to. We need our emotions. Our emotions are a huge part of being human, certainly a huge part of being lovers of God. But what we can easily do, and I reckon this is true for many of you in this room and many of you watching this on video, what we can do is be sort of carried along, even into some kind of religious lifestyle, church lifestyle, even, yeah, some level of relationship with God by just the emotions, having never really thought through whether we are genuinely persuaded, whether actually there is any truth in Christianity. We're caught up in it because it feels real. The problem with only living by what feels real is that I guarantee you there's coming a day when it won't feel real. It may be tomorrow, it may be the day after, but it's coming. It will feel less real this week than it does today. It feels less real. People get baptized. I always write letters, if I can, to the people who get baptized in church a few days later to say, I hope you're doing well, praying for you. It feels real. Jesus got baptized. What happens straight away? He goes into the desert. He goes into the wilderness. He goes into a time of trial and testing. Feels a bit less real when you're on your own in the desert. See, Peter's had this extraordinary feeling of excitement, and then the waves suddenly feel more real than Jesus. So what does he need to do? He needs to think to himself, hold on, how come a moment ago Jesus was greater than the waves, and now he's not? Is he greater than the waves or not? Is he or not? That's what he should have been asking himself. He's not. What he's doing is he's being impressed with the last thing that caught his emotions up. That's how we can live. We can live our lives basically being influenced by the last thing that caught up our emotions. And that could be anything. It could be a movie we saw. It could be a book we read. It could be a conference we went to. It could be a song we heard. It could be a conversation we had. The last thing that made the most impression on us is, wow, I'm throwing everything out for this. And some of you, you've spent your whole life throwing so many things out for the next big thing. You've got no thing left. You haven't built up a constructed a way of seeing things, a sort of a system of truth in your mind that can handle waves and wind and pressure and difficulty and adversity of various kinds. So when difficulties come, that's an emotional reality. Yeah, but wait a minute, Jesus is an emotional reality, and he's more than an emotional reality. He's objective reality. Yeah, but this feels important. This happens to everybody, right? Especially postmodern 21st century Brightonian people and Shoreham people, people from our part of the world. We're so quickly driven by the immediate, by the impulsive, by the impetuous emotional experience. We haven't even seen or understood the necessity of constructing within our minds an understanding of truth that's given to us graciously by God, which is kind of able to steady us and help us to remain in a place of security through all the batterings of life. See, we want to feel free. We don't understand the way to feel free is to construct, by the grace of God, the truth and the system of truth in our minds that will set us free. That's why Jesus said to his disciples in John chapter 8, verse 32, if you follow my teaching, you'll be my disciples. You will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. The truth. Many of us, we don't believe that, so we live instead by sheer experience. And even the truth that we receive, we don't really receive it unless it comes with an experience. And sometimes we can't even explain what it means. It just felt powerful at the time. I've heard people say, well, that was a really powerful sermon. And then a few days later, that was a really powerful sermon. And I've known, yeah, but those two sermons flatly contradicted each other. Yeah, but they were both powerful. I remember someone saying, went away for some training at a leadership event, came back and said, oh, I said, what was some good training? Get some good input, some good teaching. Yeah, there's one really powerful session where a guy took a hammer and smashed a mirror. Sounds great. Wow, that's good. Yeah, what point was he making? Oh, I don't know. I don't know what he was doing it for, but it was powerful. Now, I can guess what he might have been trying to communicate, you know, but what is the deal? You know, it's powerful because it, you know, it's powerful. I don't just have to mean anything. You know, another guy, you know, skinned a pig. What did he learn from that? No, he doesn't like pigs. I don't know. I mean, whatever seems, I could do anything here and be powerful, but that's not really the point. We don't communicate just to inspire. We communicate to help you construct an understanding of truth that, as Jesus said, will set you free. Or help you to build. Jesus talked about this in Matthew chapter 7. He talks about his teaching. And at the end of his long message, long teaching, chapter after chapter, he says, the person who follows my words is like a man who builds his house upon a rock. What's he saying? Well, think about it. What does that image suggest? What do you need to build a house? You need time. You need raw materials. You need patience. You need a plan. You need a comprehensive grasp of where different things fit in. I'm not talking about being academic, because this isn't necessarily academic. Some people who are not academic at all are stronger and clearer in their grasp of the truth that the Bible teaches than a lot of people who are academic. And a lot of people who are academic, because they've never really submitted themselves to the authority of Scripture, they might even call themselves Christians, but really they're living by experiences. And what we need, friend, is just the submission, discipline of saying, I'm gonna take this book seriously. I'm going to learn to be persuaded by what it reveals and not only be carried along by impulse, but be more and more persuaded by the truth that sets us free. Impulse is exciting, but some of us so live by it, we're like the person that's stuck at the bottom of an elevator shaft, and we're pressing the button, and it says out of order. We just keep pressing it, keep pressing it, keep pressing it. I want my life to get better. I want to be set free. I want to be changed. I want to grow. I want to develop as a Christian. I want to trust God more and have growing confidence in God. Well, there's only one way it's going to happen. That is by taking the stairs. I don't want to take the stairs. I want an encounter. I want power. I want a moment that will lift me out. And that's good when God comes. I mean, Jesus comes over, be sure. He lifts Peter out. I mean, God will do that. But if you're so living for every time, it's just, I've got to be lifted out, I've got to be lifted out. Maybe you're missing the thing that God's trying to teach you most of all. And that is, no, take the stairs. Grow in your capacity to grasp truth, understanding and faithfulness, and thereby freedom, the freedom that comes from knowing the truth. So we mustn't miss this huge lesson from Peter's life. The final thing is kind of linked to everything I've said. There's kind of a progression to these three points, and that is this indecision. So we've seen his temperament, we've seen his emotions, now we see indecision. That's kind of what's going on here. He's not wanting to make the call ultimately between which of these two things is most impressive, the storm or Jesus, the storm or Jesus, the storm or Jesus. And by staying in that place, he's yielding in the end to the power of doubt. Doubt in itself doesn't have to be a bad thing. We learn a lot of things by doubting, by asking questions effectively. That's kind of what doubt really is. It's stepping back and saying, I need to know some more things first. I want to ask a few more questions. I want to assess the options. I want to look at the different alternatives carefully. You can do a lot by doubting, but you can't live your life by doubting, because in the end, even by choosing to do that, you're making a choice. You're always making one. But the problem is that Peter here is in danger of being indecisive in a sort of self-deceiving way. This is why James says later on in the New Testament, in James chapter 1, listen to these words. The one who doubts is like a wave of the sea. It's interesting, he uses the same kind of image here. Driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He's a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. See, the word doubt actually is linked to that word double. It's double-mindedness. It's trying really to keep holding on to mutually exclusive things. I won't make the call, I won't make the call, I won't. I cannot decide, I won't decide, I won't decide. Sometimes we dress it up in academic ideas, we dress it up in cleverness, we dress it up in intellectualism. We sort of say, well, you know, I'm interested in trusting God, I'm interested in the Bible, I'm interested in Christianity, but I'm just interested, I'm fascinated, I'm interested. The person that keeps being just interested can actually come across quite impressive. The problem is you're not going to impress God that way. God will one day want you to make a decision of trust. Do I trust him? And maybe that's the case for many here, many of you in Shoreham or the Racecourse or the Villas watching this. You're in a situation, maybe in your life now, maybe you've been a Christian for years or decades. Maybe you're not a Christian at all. And you know the stage you've got to. The stage you've got to is actually one where you know enough. You know enough. You know the thing that God is calling you to do. It's not for lack of information that you're not stepping towards him. It's because you can't decide whether he's trustworthy or not. You can't decide, and you can't make that decision. And it's difficult because it's not necessarily solved just by information. It's not even solved just by emotion. The will plays a part. And sometimes we'd rather do anything. We'd rather delay the will forever. Postpone the role of the will. Keep the will out of it. I don't want to make a call. I just want to keep listening and asking questions. No, the will will start to play a part. It will gradually grow in its importance if you're going to follow God. And so we have to make one. And it's difficult. Decisions are painful. Even the word is a violent one. You ever heard this? The word decide? It literally means to cut off. That's what it means, to cut off. That's why at this time of year, you go to the woods, anywhere in Sussex, you'll find some deciduous trees. What does that mean? It means they cut off their leaves. They die to their leaves every year. They are deciduous trees. They lose things every year. They look different in December. They look bare and austere and frosty because something happens, a decision, a deciding, a dying, a cutting off happens. That's the nature of deciding. It's saying, okay, I will die to this. This option, this possibility, this opportunity is now gone because, well, I've made a decision. A death happens. It happens for a reason, for the sake of new life. Life to come, a spring will come, buds will come, fruit will come, life, foliage will come. But the process involves a dying and decisions, friends, listen to me, decisions in your life will feel like death sometimes. Decisions even to trust God and follow him. If you're waiting for the day when it feels comfortable to trust God, you may be waiting forever. Just die. Just choose to. I'm going to die to one option. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to trust him. You might think, no, the circumstances will get better. They may not. You've got to trust. You've got to be brave. You've got to decide. Because indecisiveness will actually kill you more than you think. It will totally neuter you for sure. It will render you impotent and ineffective. That's why lion tamers hold out, chair legs to lions. All right, apparently, right? I've read this, okay, so go with me. So lions, they kind of expect to hunt down and attack if there's just one chair leg. But if you're holding out three or four chair legs, that's the whole idea. Too many options, too many choices. So the lion's kind of just paralyzed by the choice, like a rabbit in the headlights, just can't do anything. It's all that's needed. Sometimes, you think the thing that's holding you back is some great problem, I can't do it because of him or because of her or because of that person. No, the thing that's holding you back is your indecision. The thing that's holding you back is the fact that you're still not prepared to die to something. I won't get rid of this thing. I won't die to it. Well, then you're going to be stuck. You're there. That's what you are. You're a toothless lion. What a shame. What a loss you are. What a disaster, what a tragedy, what potential there could be. But you're held back because you won't decide. Am I saying, therefore, we shouldn't try and persuade people to trust God? No, I'm saying we should, but I'm saying this. Sometimes a person is more persuaded than they realize. You don't need more persuasion. You know what you need to know. It's like this when someone gets married. Very often there comes a point where a guy needs to propose, but there's sometimes a point where a guy actually is thinking that what he needs is more information. More information, more information. I need to know. And it's like, you know. you've been going out with her for 4 years. You know enough. I'm not saying that you know her completely. I've been married 17 years. I have no idea. But I tell you, when I proposed to her, I knew what I needed to know. That's the thing. Do you know what you need to know for the next step? The next step in your relationship with God, you probably know more than you think about whether you can take it. So, how do we deal with this? How do we handle this indecision? How do we handle ourselves in our timidity and our temperament of second guessing? Some of you, you know that you're just like this. Our emotions of being caught up by impulse and then realizing later, I haven't really thought this through. Or just our chronic indecisiveness. Well, first things first, what are you looking at? What's the main preoccupation? What's the focus of your attention? That's important. You may not realize it, but that's really important. And it takes courage to look at the right things. To look at Jesus takes courage. To keep looking at him when there's a lot of waves, impressive waves around right now. But I still say that Jesus is bigger, greater, more important. I tell you, I'll let you in on a shameful, humiliating truth about myself, and that is that when I trained to ride a motorbike, actually on my test, I crashed. And it was really bad. I didn't pass. I had to go back later and do it. I crashed into a car that was actually not moving. Stationary car. Crashed. It's just soul-destroying. So I spoke to the instructor after. I said, what did I do wrong? He said, well, what were you looking at? I said, well, I was looking at the car. Why were you looking at the car? I didn't want to crash into it. That's why you crashed into it. You've got to look at the road. Look at the road. Look where you want to go. You'll find that you go there. It's the same with trusting God. You keep looking at the problem. Keep looking at the problem in my life. Difficulty, failure in my own, sin in my life, things in my past. I've got to sort this out. I've got real problems. Well, it's not going to solve anything. It'll just keep crashing into it. Maybe some of you, the thing you're hearing tonight is, have more faith. Where's your faith? People of little faith, where's your faith? Get your faith levels up, where's your faith? And you turn it into an exercise this week and where's my faith? Got to grow my faith. And you'll spend your whole life looking at your faith. Don't look at your faith. Look at Jesus. That's the nature of faith. Look at Jesus. Keep your focus on him. And the great thing is, as you're doing that, what you're doing is you're worshiping him. Even in your desperation, even crying out to him, look what Peter does. He gets one thing very right. He falls down, help me, Lord. He cries out. And that's exactly the right thing. Cry out to him. Don't be a wuss about it. Don't be lazy about it. Don't be dull about it. Call on him. If you're struggling to trust him, if you're going through a season of doubt where this book doesn't seem real and God doesn't seem real and Jesus just seems far away, I tell you, the worst thing to do is just get dull and lazy about it. Pray. Get up early tomorrow and pray and do it the next morning and say, God, I will seek you. I will seek you. I will seek you because your word says, if you seek me with all your heart, I will let myself be found by you, says Jeremiah 33, verse 3, and Jeremiah 29, Jeremiah 31, all those chapters in Jeremiah, read them again and again. Promises to those who seek him with all their heart. Seek him. Call on his name. And then finally, remember that it isn't about your faith, it is about his faith, actually. See, I love this story for so many reasons. But one of the things that grips me, I love this. You know how it started? Jesus said to them, right, get in the boat, go across the lake, I'll meet you. He didn't say where he was going to meet them. Go out across the lake. Go across the lake. So they go, he gets them in the boat. And then he said, I'm going to go on off ahead. And they didn't know where he's going. It just says he went up into the mountain to be alone. Why did Jesus go up into mountains to be alone? To pray. That's what he does when he's on his own in the mountain. He prays. What does he pray about? What's the thing Jesus cares about the most? What would you think Jesus would spend most of his time praying about? His church. Who are his church? Well, at the moment, they're these 12 weirdos in a boat. That's his church. We're all their offspring. If you're a Christian, yeah, you're one of the weirdos. But we've started with these 12 guys. So what's Jesus doing while they're going through the storm? They're thinking, where's he gone? We're going to die out here. Where is he? He's praying for them. He's ascended on high to the Father to pray. That's what he's done for us. It's just a picture. It's the same thing now. Jesus, now that he's died and risen from the dead to pay for our sin, to raise us with him, to be with him forever, well, he's gone on ahead. He hasn't taken us yet to glory. We don't get to be there with him yet. We're waiting for that moment. But in the meantime, we think, well, where is he? When I'm buffeted, when I'm struggling to trust, and my confidence is sapped, where is he? The Bible says he ever lives to make intercession for us. I've gone ahead to prepare a place for you. He's praying for you. Remember, one of the hardest things I went through 20 years ago as a student, one of the hardest times in my life, and it went on for months. It was heartbreaking, confusing, bewildering. I wondered what was going on. I wondered where God was. I came out of it a few months later, summer of 96, I think it was. And one of the things that happened was I kind of had this, I wouldn't say it was a vision, but I just knew it was real, where I realized Jesus was praying for me. And it's like I could sense that he was naming me, saying my name. Joel needs you, Father. Help him. You realize that's how he is to his people? He's in the mountains, yeah, but he's the mountain. He's in the mountains for you. That's what he's doing. He's preoccupied. Yeah, he's preoccupied with you. He's distant. He's distant for you. And he's not that distant anyway. He's going to come to you in the storm. He's going to come across to you by his spirit. He'll meet with you in your need. Don't get obsessive about your own faith level. Remember that he's the one that carries you. He's faithful. Peter got to know that. Over time, he got to know it. And Jesus is so committed. Peter's weak. God will make Peter strong. God will get him there. God will get you there. God will get you there. That's his plan for you. Let's pray together in response to God. Father, we are grateful for Jesus. What a savior he is. We want to learn to trust him more and more with all our lives. Amen.